Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. Good evening, everyone. Welcome back to the Sean Edward Channel with myself, Ron Swanson, and Luke from Break the Ice. Tonight, Luke is going to begin us on a journey. Apologies for the odd start. I got the time wrong, and I also booked this at a time where we've only got an hour this evening. So we're going to just be, I'm going to save the usual 15 minutes of me talking nonsense, and we'll get diving into this in a minute. But Luke has, I mean, it's fair to say you've got a fairly extensive knowledge in the Moors murders, mate. I mean, let's be honest.
And sadly, I know a lot about the Moors murders, yeah.
Yeah. And it's one of those cases that I think, especially in the UK, I think you'd be hard-pressed to not find anyone who's heard of it, right? And you know the true extent of just how horrific it all was. Also, the sort of landmark case that it was. But really getting a deep dive into it in 2024 is something I'm excited about. I pre-warned everyone last night that I'm probably going to be fanboying out during this one and just taking it all in, because this ain't my wheelhouse, this case, and I'm really excited to delve into it. So
yeah, you're excited to learn about the in-depth, like, kind of personal kind of experience of it that I've got as well. So I'm looking forward to sharing what I know, you know, broader than what you can just find on the TV. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's really weird. The more I look at this picture of Myra Hindley, the more she reminds me of the evil, twisted sister of one of my mother's friends. They've got quite similar features, if I'm being honest. It's quite funny.
If you look at that right now, I've got, might as well get the plug straight away.
Yeah.
I've got a video premiering at 8:15. We finish at 8:00.
Yeah.
I've got a video premiering at 8:15, and it is called, Was Myra Hindley Actually Released from prison on the quiet? Now, everyone make sure you get over to that on my channel. It is going to be a live premiere. Now, that picture is mentioned and it's talked about by Myra Hindley's brother-in-law. Yeah, that picture there. And he says, look at that picture, right? Can you get closer in on that?
Yeah, let me pull you up a slightly better one. One sec.
So he says about this, and I won't spoil what he says too much, but he goes, look at that face. He goes, look at the hard jawline. Look at the hard case. And then look at those eyes. He goes, they're black. They're empty. And he goes, there's not a spark in those eyes. And he goes, that's the Myra that I know. Not me. That's what he said. That's the Myra I know. Not the one in prison with cuddly toys, smiling to the camera. He said, that is the absolute Myra Hindley, the epitome of what she, if you could summarize what she was all about, that picture is it.
Yeah. Well, here, this is the thing. There's actually quite a lot of chatter going around about the possibility of a release of Myra Hindley and relocation, of course. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, the British government does have a bit of a reputation for very, very heavily funded second chances for some fairly notorious individuals. And, you know, for me, you got to understand, I love a side quest or a side story from a mainstream story like this that gives us another thought process, and it's certainly an interesting one. It's certainly an interesting one. No problem.
We're going to take this on a bit of a series, aren't we, Ron? Because there's a lot to talk about.
Yeah, there is.
There's a lot of personal experience I've got with one of the family members. For anyone that isn't aware, my kind of journey with the Moors murders, well, it began when I learned about it when I was about 10 years old. But my work, I come from the Manchester area. I don't know if you can tell by this thick accent, but my creative content journey started on this in 2002 when I just sent a message out to Terry Kilbride, who was the second victim's brother-in-law. Have you got the victims up there? Can you pull them up?
Yeah, I do. I think I do. 1 second.
And I'll point out for anyone that...
It's five, right? Five in total.
It is five. Yeah. So you've got John Kilbride is the fourth one across.
That's
John. Right. He got snatched when he was 12 years old. Now, I reached out to his brother, Terry, and there's a whole playlist on my channel on Break the Ice about the Moores murders, not just content about the Moores murders, but content that I did with Terry. Terry was 9 when John went missing, when John was snatched. So Terry remembers this very, very vividly. And we made a documentary, a 2-part documentary. We went to visit all the graves together. Not long before Terry actually passed away, he actually kindly asked me, yeah, there you go, that's the playlist there. So, and there'll be one more video on there at 8:15, the Myra Hindley released from prison one. We went to all of the graves, and then he kindly invited me to, he got snatched from Ashton Market, where he was basically he was trying to make some pocket money to give half to his mum and half for himself. And he was basically moving boxes around, you know, just a bit of labour kind of work. And Myra asked him if she could help him move some boxes into her car. And he was not seen again for two years. And at this time, no one knew about Myra Hindley and Ian Brady. So this family, they had no idea where he was. So in this interview, we learn all about what it was like in those 2 years, what they went through. You can see the pictures in the background of the thumbnail on that Moores murders one at the top.
Yeah, just here.
Yeah, yeah, right at the top there. His mum traveled everywhere. How she would still. So I've got some placemats in front of me, funnily enough. I'm on a dining room table. She put a placemat out every Sunday, waiting for John to come back, hoping, praying that he'd come back. And they didn't know where he was for 2 years. And yeah, we went to the place where he was. They put a memorial plaque up last year to mark 60 years. And that's in Ashton Market where he was took from. And Terry invited me. If you go back on that playlist again, if you don't mind, Terry invited me to go and, where is it now? It's got the third from the bottom. There, yeah. So he invited me to go and do an interview with him outside it. He got emotional. It's the first time I'd ever seen him kind of well up. And we did a little piece outside there. And we went, like I said, we went to the graves. I've been to the house. This is not with Terry. This is after he passed. Yeah, this is the introduction to that. No.
And the occasional sheep is seen to graze where birds elegantly fly in the sky. But this is tragically most known for possibly the most heinous and infamous crimes in British history. This is the home of the Moores murders. Between 1963 and 19...
People should go and check this out.
4 innocent children, all at the beginning of their lives, were lured onto these moors. Their kind and caring nature pounced upon and manipulated by pure evil. One of the victims was 12-year-old John Kilbride.
Yeah, man. It looks like you've done your research and you've really deep dived into the history of a lot of these individuals. And I've shared the playlist. I, honestly, if anyone wants to take that step further after this, make sure you leave a like and subscribe for our Luke. But where did it take you next, Luke, after this documentary? Like, what was the...
So, basically, after... when I reached out to Terry in the first place, and then we'll get on to then about how Myra and Brady actually met, but starting with this is... I spoke to him and I said to him that I want to make this about, like, not just about these two scumbags that are on the screen now, but obviously they are going to be spoken about. They are the elephant in the room. But I want to learn about what I want to learn. I want to learn more about how it affected the. You don't see documentaries about what was it like for the families in those in that time when these kids were missing. What was it like in those 2 years? What was it like looking for him? What and then what was John like before? He's not just a victim of, you know, murder. He was a person, and I wanted to know more about him. And he gave me the chance to make this documentary with him. And what he was very, very passionate about, he wanted to get his sister-in-law Anne involved in the documentary because her brother, Terry's brother, Danny Kilbride, was very instrumental in campaigning to keep Braden Hindley in prison because there was calls for parole for her. He's not so much him. He didn't really give a shit. But he was the one that got hundreds of thousands of signatures from all over the world to keep her inside. And without his hard work, she would have been released very likely, possibly in the 80s, but a lot earlier. And it was his hard work that kept her out. And Terry really wanted that to be in. And they've done documentaries with Channel 4, ITV, with all the broadcasters you could name. And they're all like, yeah, yeah, we will, you know, we'll keep that bit in. And they just cut it out and they made it a Myra Hindley and Ian Brady kind of glory fest. It's all about them, blood, guts, and murder. And I made this documentary and I stuck by my word and I kept that part in. That was very important. Once we'd made it, he then rang me and I was bricking it because I was thinking, like, he's going to tell me his opinion of this now because I showed it him before publicly.
Sure, of course.
And I'm thinking, shit, like, you know, this is a brother of a victim here. I've just made this documentary. This has got, you know, this has got to like, he's got to like this. And he rang me, and I've always said this on my channel, like, it's my proudest piece of work because he rang me, and I went, hiya, Terry. He went, I'll tell you what, Luke. He talked like that, and he goes, you've made our John proud. Now, what better can you get than to hear that?
100%. 100%.
So yeah, it was a touching moment, and from then he knew that he could trust me, and then we, like I said, he got asked. I think he got asked by Granada to go and do, which I don't know if you heard of Granada, but it's like a regional kind of news.
Yeah, yeah, and I know.
They asked him to open this plaque or go and do a piece there, and he asked me if I'd do it with him, which I jumped at. And then he kindly enough, he had letters. This is another thing that's on the playlist. Ian Brady liked to send letters to the victim's family members. He got them fucked up.
Yeah.
Now, the worst letters were sent to Winnie Johnson. Winnie Johnson was... Keith Bennett's mum, Keith Bennett, who is still missing. So he would plead and beg that he would reveal where Keith is, and he would just toy with her and whatnot. And he famously once said to his psychotherapist there's our Keith. I used to speak to his brother a fair bit. We'll get onto that later in the series about his brother and the search that he does up there. Where was I with my Fred then? Lost my Fred.
You just touched on the fact that Keith had never been found, and yeah, you're just going to have to keep. I find it hard enough to keep track of my own threads.
Before I talked about Keith, but yeah, with Terry, I've lost a thread, but yeah, we went and did the plaque, and then we went. That was it. We're talking about the letters that Brady sent, right?
Dude, listen, side chat. someone's going to have to take notes on this, because this is going to be what happens for the next 3 weeks. Okay, because he's talking, and while he's talking, I'm Googling what he's talking and bringing up images that are related to what he's talking about. Okay, whilst acting like I'm in conversation. Okay, yes, it was the letters.
No, I'll just keep talking. So he famously once said to a psychotherapist about Keith Bennett, and this, you may not have heard, you probably haven't heard this, but if anyone's not heard this, this, it might send a shiver down your spine.
Okay.
He said about Keith's whereabouts, which to this day, we don't know. He said, I know, you don't know, you want to know, and I won't tell you. How messed up is that? How sick is that? So, yeah. Winnie Johnson endured a lifetime of torture. Alan is still alive and he's still going through it now. The Kilbrides got sent letters. Leslie Ann Downey's mother got sent letters. They all did. Pauline Reed. I'm not so sure about Edward Evans. Didn't have a large family. But Terry gave me some letters for me and Brady. Now, I was sat there. You imagine this, Ron and chat. Imagine this, okay? I'm sat there in Terry's flat in Ashton, where the same area where John was took from. And his missus came over when we were talking off camera. And she just plonks these bit of paperwork down next to me in the armchair. I'm like, I went, what's that? She went, there are letters from him. I went, who's him? She went, Brady. And I jumped a little bit and I was like, whoa. Yeah. And at first I couldn't touch them. Knowing where his hands have been.
Like actual written letters, not photocopies.
No. Like letters from Brady sent from prison to the addresses of the Kilbrides or the Downies or the Bennetts or whoever. They were his letters.
Wow.
So Terry said to me, I can't make heads or tails of these letters. I can't understand them. So he gave them me. I asked for them. I said, give me a couple of weeks and let me see if I can just have a look. And I learned, like, well, that looks like a letter S. That looks like a letter. I basically worked out what all his letters were, because he writes in such a weird way. I kind of made my own alphabet of what his letters were. Once I got the alphabet, I could then put the letter together. And so, but if you go again back onto the playlist, and one of your many tabs, it's in that bright green thumbnail there. That is the letter that I kind of decoded there. That was given to me from what's happened there? What is that? An advert?
It's just loading.
Oh, yeah. Adverts, eh? Where would it be without?
Yeah, gotta love them.
If you unmute it, but if you start again and
long and short,
that's him.
Yeah,
Iranian Arab freedom fighters at the Scrubs. I met hundreds of long and short term prisoners, including Sutcliffe. The first 5 years were in Durham's special security wing with the train robbers, Craze, spies, Richardson's, etc. Hi, everybody. So today's a very interesting one.
Now I go into it.
Especially if you are interested in true crime, and even more so.
So if anyone wants to check that out, anyone that's obviously on this channel watching this video right now is interested in the case, go over to my channel, subscribe, and get onto that playlist. And it's all there. It's all there.
Yeah, it's quite extensive. It's quite amazing as well, the inside stuff that you have that no one else has really sort of touched on, especially with the families and these letters and your interviews, Luke. But take us to the beginning of this nightmare when
you met.
Yeah, when these two, you know, their paths crossed. However it was, whether it was destiny, whether they were, you know, brought together because of their mental compatibility, shall we say, What do you think?
Yeah, so basically, so he was born in the slums in Glasgow. She was born in Gorton. She was born to a kind of, you know, working class family, quite normal at the time. His childhood wasn't the greatest. He was like, got into petty crime and stuff like that. And he was getting in trouble from quite a young age, and he had personality traits which transpired into what he became. You know, just odd, the odd, quite odd, bit cruel, that kind of stuff, and the petty crime. He actually then moved. He wasn't living with his natural parents, and then he moved back to Manchester to live with his mum. I hope that bird's not really loud outside.
But oh, it's loud. Don't worry. It's loud. A cat. He's got a cat that sounds like a freaking motorbike that starts up.
Sounds like a Yamaha. So I'll shut that anyway. So he moved back down from Glasgow, and he moved in with his biological mum again. And she was with a man, and he took his stepfather's surname. So he became Ian Brady. Now, he had a godlike complex where he thought he was... He referred to the regular person as maggots, basically. He was intellectually superior in his own mind. And Myra, kind of a typical upbringing, though she got the odd belt by her dad, I suppose. Back in those days, you might have done in the 50s and 60s. She moved out of her family home to live with her nana. But it was, you could see the both houses from the window. It was kind of like one row backing onto another kind of thing. She was known to be quite tough, but quite a normal girl. She actually experienced death at a young age because someone that she knew fell into Gorton Reservoir, Manchester, and died. Whether that had any effect, I don't know, but from everything I've ever looked into, she was fairly normal, if not tough, and, you know, a leader. Now, she met Brady at a paper merchant, and what she noticed, he was like kind of a manager there, but what she noticed about Brady was that he was like intellectual, he read books, not like bad books, you know. He was into Hitler tapes, and she saw him as and big band music. She saw him as very, very different. She always said, he's the first guy she met who had really clean fingernails. So he's just that in her eyes, different. I believe that he saw something in her as he always wanted to commit the perfect murder, and he wanted to, it's committing the perfect murder. Apparently it's not as fulfilling, if you're into that, if you can't share it with somebody. So we wanted to bring Myra in to share that with him. And they got together, but their relationship wasn't one. People believe of two people falling in love and wanting marriage. And are you all right, and Astro Wolf? It wasn't of... one of love and marriage and one of children. It was the connection, the shared enjoyment of sadism and cruelty.
Do you think that for individuals like that gives them an initial sense of they're no longer alone? They found their dark other half, and it's almost, they get almost drunk with that in their mind. Do you see what I mean? Because if they've both wanted something like this for so long and finally get it, it would have been like an overindulgence.
Let's put it into perspective. So let's say, like, okay, let's talk about the recent, like, the big event, right, of like Oasis getting back together, right? Okay. Now imagine one fan of Oasis, okay? Yeah, it would be great to go and watch Oasis, but I don't want to go and watch it on my own. Like, this is the normal mind. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want to go and watch it on my own, but like, yeah, I'm still down for it. I'm still digging it. I'm still mad for it. But if you find someone else that loves them just as much as you, to share that with them. Now put that into a murderer, someone with those tendencies. You can share it then. They got together. He wanted to commit the perfect crime, but he was very focused on, he wanted to kill children. But he couldn't, back in the 60s, a man couldn't obtain, couldn't go out and obtain a child, or he couldn't go, you know, come to my car or whatever it may be. They're going to be like, nope, I'm warned about dangerous men. So he got Myra to procure the victims. Myra drove. He didn't even drive. He couldn't drive. So the reason why a lot of people say she was worse than him is because A, she befriended these children and used her kind of femininity and the fact that she was a woman and we trust women to lure them in. And then she used her car to drive them up to the malls where he would sometimes be waiting, or she would be driving her car down a road. He would be in front on a motorbike. And if he saw a potential victim, he would, he might be behind.
Yeah.
He would flash his motorbike light. That meant to her, that person is the victim that Brady wants. And then she would do what she needed to do to get that victim in. And her first victim, this leads us on well, her first victim was actually a childhood friend, Pauline Reed. She was off to a dance. She was a neighbour and a friend of Myra. And she was off to a dance and she pulled up and she spoke to Pauline. And Pauline said she was going to this dance and Myra offered her a lift. And then because she trusted Myra, Myra said, do you mind coming up to the moors? Which wouldn't have been that far away from where they were, because I've lost a glove and Ian will go crazy if I can't find this glove. And she drove. What's that?
Oh, no, I'm talking to the side chat to, oh, to right, read okay. this. He's just talking, he's just talking, yeah, he's really just, well, he or she, Soul Knight, what's happening, my G, just basically saying that there's so many cases of unhinged horror. And, I mean, he nailed it with the old Nazis during the German World War II period. And some of the Nazis, man, as they have to be known when you're speaking to an algorithm.
I get you. I'm with you.
I mean, some of the scientists, right, that escaped the Nazi Germany was wild. And it's insane. They all went to Argentina, okay? Whatever they say, that's where they all went. Okay, I'm just saying Hitler lived there for years, but we're not going to talk about that tonight. So, I mean, you could agree with that, though, right? I mean, these were two prime examples of dark, dark individuals. I mean, praying
he was a Nazi.
Okay, well then that then we're cool. All right.
He was. He listened to Hitler tapes. He listened to I don't want to misquote the book. What's that book called? The 1 second.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Yeah, I agree, Pauline.
Hold on.
Listen, whoa, okay, so here's that's the one, Yuri. Do you know what I'm saying? I often say to people, the only person that I know who isn't one of these people truly is myself. And that's
all we can ever know, isn't it?
That's all we can ever know. And it's mad because if you want to get truly philosophical, I mean, obviously we can be like, no, my family, and I get it, I'm the same. But when you want to get really philosophical, is that the right word? I think it is. You only really know yourself. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you were telling us about their tactics, her car, his bike, the signaling, and you know, so keep going with this.
Yeah, so with the first victim, Pauline, that was the first one. She was, I believe she was 16. The second oldest, so they did get younger progressively, kind of. And Myra denies that when she pulled up, this is down the line in prison, she didn't know it was Pauline. Whether that's relevant or not, you still, you know, lured someone in, knowing where they were going. There she is, bless her. So she was took to the moor to find the glove, and then apparently she was left with Ian Brady to, I'm not going to call him Ian actually, left with Brady to go and find this glove. And I think you can use your imagination as to what happened next. Now, what people may not know, though, now it's BS that Myra wasn't there. She was there. She's heard very loud and clear on a tape with Leslie Ann Downey. Now, what is kind of the thought and the feeling is that Brady was the one that abused the boys, and she was the one that abused the girls. Some people say that Brady was bi at best, and she had a lot of lesbian relations in prison. So this is why I go back to that. This wasn't a relationship of, you know, attraction and love and that kind of stuff. It was, yeah, I found my person here who shares the same twisted interests.
Yeah.
So Pauline was number one. Let me just pull something up one moment.
Yeah, you're good. Just while we're taking this moment, can you all make sure you're liking and subscribing? Luke's links are down in the channel down in the description box down below. I'm Googling stuff I shouldn't be Googling whilst you're talking about this case.
What do you mean you should? What do you mean that you shouldn't be?
Yeah, I looked at the transcript, man.
Oh, the Leslie Ann Downey transcript.
Yeah.
Now, look. Thankfully, that recording does not. It's never. In the modern day, it probably would have got leaked, and that would have been outrageous. But that has been locked away in an archive. It is not available. It's never been available. But the transcript is there. Now, what's so sad about Leslie Ann? She was only like 10. And I met her brother. So there's three brothers. Terry became a friend. Leslie's brother I met once at Terry Kilbride's funeral, and he always blamed himself. He was so broken because she was took from a fair on Boxing Day, and he was supposed to take her to this fair. But he came down with flu-like symptoms. So Leslie's mum arranged that she'd go with a friend. And he's always, always said, like, if I would have been there, she wouldn't have got took. And he's always blamed himself. So when I met him, I mean, just looking at him, it makes you emotional. Because you can see, you can see pain. It's almost like saying you can see, color. You can see sound. You shouldn't be able to see sound. Yeah. I could see pain written on his face, in his soul. But with Leslie, going back to like how Myra was the one that abused the girls, the tape recording of Leslie, where she was being abused, she was being tortured, all sorts of things were said. But it was Myra that's mainly on that tape saying, do this, do that, or I'll hit you one, et cetera, et cetera. And Leslie Ann Downey was actually calling Myra mummy. And mummy.
And it was that by, you know, obviously that's obviously by Myra's orders, right?
No, it wasn't. It was to try, and the people that studied the reason why are saying that this is like this is something that's kind of built into people. It's trying to get to her maternal.
Almost like a Hail Mary.
Yeah, like, it's like she's trying to pull out that maternal side of her that she didn't even have. She caught Brady.
Oh, not like that. Sorry, not in a Hail Mary as in a religious sense, in an American football terminology, where it's like your last ditch effort, and you've got to go, and you go Hail Mary, and it's and that is quite upsetting.
I'm to think she was only 10 as well. To think she was only 10, and she had that. Clearly quite bright to use that technique to try and get to that maternal part of her. And she also said, like, let me go and I won't tell mummy. I won't tell my mummy what happened. And she was found in the moors. I've got the order. I do know the order, but I wouldn't want to get it wrong. So it's Pauline Reed, who was the first victim. And she would. I explained how she was taught. Let's move, because we're going to do this in a series. We're going to talk about who was took and where they were took from and what kind of happened. And then, say, episode two, we'll talk about it all being uncovered. So, John Kilbride was actually the second. Now, like I said, John was he was working on Ashton Market, and he was just moving boxes to make pocket money. And this is the kind of personal attachment I have with this one, because I did know Terry very well. I'm very close with Terry's children. He's got like 5 sons and a daughter. We're all really close. His widow, we speak from time to time. It's quite a personal one, and we used to speak all the time, just not even about this, just chatting about football and whatever, and we really built a friendship and a trust. That's why we did so much work together. And John was lured away again by Myra with the boxes. Can you help me carry these boxes to the car? And he did. And again, like, if you're gonna go and check anything out on the playlist, the documentary interview that I did with him is the one to watch, because it's first hand account of. You know, he was 9. He remembers John leaving the house in the morning and not coming back. So, that's probably the one. If you're going to watch one, that's the one to watch.
Yeah.
He was took up to the moors and he was assaulted. I'm not going to go too graphic, but he was assaulted and he was strangled with his own. They tried to slit this part. Yeah. Again, trying to be algorithm friendly. Tried to slit this part, but the knife was too blunt. So they strangled him with his shoelaces. And he was buried on there. And they didn't know where he was for 2 years. No one knew. And like I said, they were out looking and buying Christmas presents and birthday presents and putting food on the table on a Sunday.
Losing a child is unbelievable, but the thought of one vanishing, right, without a conclusion.
Yeah.
It's
horrible, isn't it?
So
in that interview, he goes into, like I said, like, you know, what were those 2 years like? And he just said, like, he said in his words, quoting him now, he went, looking for a better word, the house went dead. He said, my mum was singing and dancing and she just stopped doing it. My dad hit the booze hard. His dad was originally prime suspect.
Wow.
As a lot of times in these cases they are. But then he got a lot of, he couldn't imagine being accused. But knowing that you didn't do it and you just really wanted your son back.
Yeah. I see, there's that side of it. And then on top of that, you've got at a later date, Ian Brady sending letters out, making a mockery of the situation. Mm. And I'm telling you now, I think that if that little boy's body had been found or announced, I think Brady would have dropped dead that day. I think that was the only thing that kept him in that darkness permanently, was that little bit of power that he had over that body.
Well, this will blow your mind as well then, because Brady,
listen, my mind is getting repeatedly blown this evening, so let's keep it going. Brady, my eyes doing a madness too. It's having a mad night to itself.
Brady liked to have power all the way to the end, and obviously you took Keith's resting place, his where he was buried, to his grave. Now, what many people will not know, so I got a few exclusives with Terry in the documentary interview we did. I won't reveal all of them because I would like people to watch it, but one it will do. Now, this is so sickening. Ian Brady actually died on John Kilbride's birthday. Not many people know this.
Yeah, spooky.
And I asked, well, here's the thing. It ain't no coincidence, we believe, because speaking with Terry, and he goes into this, is that he knew that Ian Brady was ill. He knew that he was getting ill. And he knew that he was probably coming to the end, but he was still on medication. If he'd have stayed on medication, he would have stuck around for a few more weeks. Now, for how much of a sick, disgusting human being he was, he was intelligent, and he probably did know.
Are you telling me that you think Brady timed his own death by limiting his own medication?
I'm
not saying you're wrong. I'm just making sure that
you are getting me right, Terry.
So now that little boy's birthday forever
is the same day as when Brady died.
Wow.
That's another bit.
Can I ask you this? Let me get deep with you.
Yeah, of course.
Is that not, in essence, the perfect crime?
I suppose that, like, even after death...
Take away freedom and all our concepts of what winning is, right? And ask yourself, did Brady actually achieve what he wanted to achieve? Because
after death, he probably knew, well, I've got Keith Bennett. I've got the Keith Bennett secret. What else can I have? And he played an instrumental part in the 80s in Myra not getting parole in the 80s. Whether she got out later on, when you come over to my channel at 8:15, we will go down the hole of the rabbit hole of, did she actually get released? Now, talking to Terry about Brady's death, he knew he was ill, and the belief is that he thought, right, if I stop my medication, let's say 36 hours before or a day before, whatever, I don't know how it works medically, I will then die on John Kilbride's birthday. And that is exactly what Terry and I believe happened. That is why this is one of the maddest cases and one of the sickest peoples, both of them.
See, when we talk about demonic forces, right, or dark forces,
yeah.
Would that not seem like a gift that would be bestowed upon you by a dark force, picking the time of your own death to so poetically line up with this little boy? That is dark. That is deep and dark.
It's very, very, very dark. Yeah, and not. And also, as a side note, one of Terry's children also has that birthday.
Oh, wow.
So I don't know whether Brady knew this, but, you know, it's still, it, you know, it'll taint that it will take that person's birthday.
It's, of course it will.
It's John every year. On John's birthday, they'll just remember that that evil sick bastard died on the same day. Yeah, it's really messed up stuff. So
he, but you know what's even more frustrating?
Go on.
It was on his terms.
It was on his terms.
In this whole outline, it's an, like you can't even say, "Oh," and then he had a heart attack eating his cream corn in the canteen and fell head first into his plate. This was, do you know what? A lot of times, true crime is dark and all the rest of it, but you get through it, right?
Yeah.
And kind of have room for, you know, lifting the spirits a little bit. But I think Ian Brady might be the one case where punishment, prison and death weren't punishment enough. Like, I hate to say, like, almost satisfying conclusion. Right, to someone getting what they deserve.
Yeah.
And he even took away how it ended.
Yeah.
And he died in a way that immortalized himself.
Yeah.
And arguably, as I rant, it wasn't even as if he put a rope around his neck. He timed it so it happened naturally.
So it was natural, yeah.
Do you see what I mean? In certain Christian faiths, all he has to do is repent before that happens. Okay, he's had a natural death. Do you see what I'm saying? It's wild. See, when you get real deep on it all, it's wild, man.
That's why this is why spending time with Terry and with the Kilbride family and getting to know them with everything that they know. And that they told me and that they brought me into. I mean, there's other things that you will learn in that documentary. There's a lot of things. But letting me in, it's like, I just look at, and there might be a few of them watching now. I know certainly one or two are. And the amount of respect I have for that family is there's no words to say how much respect I have for that family, the strength that they've got. And how they brought me in. They brought me in, like when he passed away, there was Terry's wife and the children were in the hospital room, and I went down to I heard he was towards the end, and I just wanted to say a few words to him. And I got to the hospital and I didn't realise I knew he was coming to the end, but I didn't realise how close it was. I thought there was days left, it was hours. And all the family were there, and I was like, sorry, shit, I'll turn around, you know, like, I shouldn't be, you're all here, I'll come back when no one's here. And they, one of the sons said, no, he would want you to be in there. So I got to see him on his deathbed and say a few words 2 hours before he passed away, and his family let me in there. And I'll never forget Terry never, you know, he's an old school man. He never said, like, you know, how much kind of like our friendship meant to him, or I never realized how close and how much he thought of me with my work I'd done with him. Because that old school kind of guy, you don't spill that out. But the nature of the fact that his children said, no, he wants you in here, shows to me that what he said to them about our work together. And then
do you know what's mind-boggling, right?
Go on.
Like, you're talking about the final moments in a man's life, right? And because of your professionalism, right, and the way that you handled things, you were invited in by the family. Now, why has it taken a YouTuber, right, in the history of this case, to be the only person that has created a bond with these families? Like, I'm not taking anything away from what we do here on YouTube, but we get criticized so much as
I appreciate you saying that, Ron,
because I'm telling you, there's been a lot of Moore's murder stuff. I remember it when I was tiny. Like, we're talking on the big 80s bulb TVs. The Moore's murders. Dun, 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 dun. Like, it just seems wild that everyone just gets like used.
He told me. Now, this is the thing. When we met up, and he said, "I've done dozens of documentaries. I think I've seen all of them." And Terry was in a lot of them, and his brother before him, Danny, was the spokesperson for the Kilbrides before Terry was. And he said to me, like, "We want to get the bit in about all of the campaigning that Danny did to keep Myra Hindley and Brady in prison." We want to get this information in. We want you to learn that John went to work to give half his money to his mum, that he was good at football, that he used to come in whistling, that he was a leader. But all these production companies come in and they say, yeah, we'll do that, we'll do that. And they edit the shit out of it, yeah? And then it's like you said, that Myra Hindley, Ian Brady, then it's John's just mentioned, Leslie's mentioned, Keith's mentioned, Pauline's mentioned, and Edward's mentioned, and it's all about them too. Whereas these five on the screen now should be the ones that are mainly spoken about. So when I made this documentary, and obviously, like you said, you can't make it without talking about Brady and Hindley. Like, you have to speak about them and things that they've done and what they've said and whatnot. But a large chunk of it is about John and is about the other children. And I stuck to my word with him and I said, I will not manipulate this edit and make it all about them. And people will see if they go and check it out. That's what I did.
And someone just got a phone call. So I imagine Luke will be back in just a minute once whoever is calling him has got what they need from him. But listen, I've been sucked into this all night and sort of, you know, Googling the names that are coming up and looking at, you know, just the long-term effect of this whole case on the families, on the whole country. It's one of those cases that has a haunting set of, you know, sets of imagery that we've already looked at. These ones, you're not forgetting those faces in a while, you know, and it just seems, hang on a second, yeah, Bucko, it was wild days. And I think for me, let me just get my rant stance here. I think for me, when we have serial killers, hang on a second. Yeah, look, if you're here, we can. How do you come back? I don't know. Remove yourself completely from the stream, right? Like, exit the stream so that you drop out of the green room and then rejoin me. That should fix it. Let me just try and kick you. I don't know how to kick you. Oh, yeah, you need to just click leave studio, bro. Oh, Luke can't work his thing. Anyway, listen, it's one of those cases, and obviously we've got the severe abuse and horrific torture and abuse that went on.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.